Welcome to the New York Times Podcast, your I Can't Move, I Can't Sing of Music, News, and Criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. Because I love you too much, baby. Suspicious Minds, Elvis Presley. We're taking the time machine on this week's episode. We are going to talk about the career of Elvis Presley as filtered through the fantastical lens of Baz Luhrmann in the new biopic Elvis, which I saw and I very much liked. I understand there are problems with it. However, as a film-going experience, I thought it was close. I don't want to say top rate, but it was up there. It was very good. We are going to be having two conversations today. First, A.O. Scott, a.k.a. Tony, is going to come through and talk about Baz Luhrmann as a filmmaker and the biopic tradition and how this movie is or is not faithful to the spirit of Elvis and who the hero of the movie really is. Later, Alana Nash is going to call in, and Alana is an Elvis historian, has written a bunch of books, and we are going to get a little bit more in the weeds about what's real, what's not, and whether it's important if it's real or not. The legacy of Elvis Presley is not an uncomplicated one. Elvis, depending how you look at him, is either a kind of radical innovator of music styles, someone who helped popularize styles that had been predominant in Black popular music of the day and brought them into white spaces, again, often derided for that. Elvis was a hero to most, but he never meant to me. Yes, he's straight out racist. The sucker was simple and plain. Give in, John Wayne. As I was saying, not everybody is a fan of what Elvis did or what Elvis represents, but Elvis in many ways does set the template for a lot of the popular music developments of subsequent generations. The long history of pop music is often the history of negotiated tensions between white and Black communities, between white and Black performers, often with white performers popularizing styles that were innovated by Black musicians. This is a persistent issue. It's not something that the film necessarily wants to engage with at a high level. It more wants to let you know that Elvis operated from a place of reverence and appreciation, and that he was in turn appreciated by his Black peers. Again, we're going to get into that a little bit later in the episode, but it is a complicated legacy, and this is a film that potentially is more interested in fantasy than true legacy. Before we pivot into the conversation, I've been getting a couple of emails about challenges finding the Discord. And to be completely fair, I have been sent a link. I have a link saved. I know how to find the Discord, but it's not easy to find maybe on your own. And maybe if you're searching for it, it's not coming up. I also saw there's 900 people in the Discord now, which, hello, incredible. So let's get that number jumping. I made a tiny URL for both the Discord and the Facebook group, and hoping it'll be easier to find. It is tinyurl.com/popcastdiscord, tinyurl.com/popcastfacebook. The first will take you right to the Discord landing page. The second will take you to the Facebook group sign-up page or request page. Hopefully that makes it easier for folks. I will try to, on subsequent episodes, remind everybody that there is a smoother path. So that said, let us get into the episode. A.O. Scott is here. A.O.
How are you, John?
Tony's been on the show a bunch, and Tony reviewed the Elvis movie, and I should just come right out and say it, Tony, which is I've really enjoyed this film. And before the people are just like, oh, how could you? The problems, the historical inaccuracies. Yes, I get it. Obviously. Don't come at me. Don't at me about this. But as an entertainment experience in a largely empty BAM theater, maybe five other people in the theater, for someone who has not been to the movies a bunch in the last 2.5 years, maybe this is like the second or third film I've seen in the theater, I actually found myself largely enraptured, overjoyed. I could feel my cheekbones rising. I could feel the sweat coming out at the right moments. It was...
Did you feel your temperature rising?
It's rising right now, if I'm being honest. Just talking about it. I thought it was a success, and I felt like it could have gone another half hour, and I would have been fine. I found it tactile and vivid and I'm generally mixed on Baz Luhrmann, but an apt match of director, writer, and subject matter. I know you felt a little differently about that.
I felt a little differently, but I agree with what you just said. And I have to say that in the context of the musical biopic genre, this has a lot going for it. Because the thing about Baz Luhrmann is that he's not literal-minded. He is not a realist. So the idea of getting back to the real biographical, authentic Elvis Presley and showing what his life was like and where he came from and putting that in a whole arc of ruin and redemption is not interesting to Baz Luhrmann. What is interesting to Baz Luhrmann is sensation, is what it felt like to be Elvis and to see Elvis and to live in this imaginative world that Elvis constructed around himself. And so it's very theatrical, it's very operatic, it's very over the top. And when it's doing that, when it's in this mode of high camp, supercharged spectacle, it's really fun and it's really good. And it also, I think, gets at something important about its subject.
It is the correct medium, literally the correct medium for this subject. I was trying to imagine a Elvis biopic made by a great but perhaps more conventionally minded director. I was thinking, man, it would play as pure tragedy, or it would play as pure farce, or maybe it would even play as pure sex. Who can say? But the Baz Luhrmann approach, as you say, not reliant upon the inconvenience of reality, turns it into hyper-real theater. It's, we keep seeing in the film, we keep seeing like the outside of the casino, right? The outside of the International Casino. And you think about the falsity of Vegas and kind of the self-invention. Elvis didn't need the casino for the self-invention. Elvis is the casino. He is the invention. He is the Las Vegas of human beings. That's how this movie plays.
Exactly. And also shows where that came from in a way, because the precursor to Las Vegas is the world that Colonel Tom Parker comes from, partly of the carnivals, of these sort of low rent, very cheesy traveling shows. And the thing that Baz Luhrmann absolutely gets right, there's some things that he doesn't, in my view, quite get right, but the intense vulgarity of American popular culture, and I don't mean that in a judgmental, condescending way, just the excess of it is something that he's really tuned into and that he really appreciates and that he really loves and that he tries to match with his own aesthetic, which is fascinating to me because he's from Australia. He comes out of a different cultural and pop cultural tradition, but he locates the energy, both the rock and roll energy and the Las Vegas energy, and the whole crazy Americanness of Elvis Presley, which many people have written about and mused upon and analyzed in a way that I don't think filmmakers who felt more responsible about the material would have been able to do.
It's nice to be irresponsible sometimes. And I should say, I have historically been mixed on Luhrmann projects. I wrote about him for that Netflix hip-hop show that he engineered, The Get Down, which did also have this kind of like blend of fantasy and reality, but I think maybe he struggled with the part where he felt like he had to hew to the reality that didn't necessarily telegraph as much. In your review, you liken this film to a vampire movie, which is funny. To me, the comic book touchstones I thought were, or the moments of comic book referencing were important because it did play like more like a, almost like a conventional superhero film, albeit with a sad ending. Talk to me about the vampiric aspects, because in a way, that is Elvis's superpower.
Right, right. It's constructed around his relationship with Colonel Tom Parker, who's played by Tom Hanks under a mountain of prosthetic makeup with this bizarre accent, because Colonel Tom Parker was not actually a colonel, and his name was not Tom Parker, and he was not, as he claimed sometimes, to be from West Virginia. He was from the Netherlands and had emigrated during the war and was a very mysterious and dishonest and corrupt character. And so he's the monster in this movie. It's also a kind of a Faust story with him as Mephistopheles. It's Robert Johnson sold his soul to the devil at the crossroads, Elvis Presley sold his soul to Colonel Tom Parker is the gist of it. He's the nemesis. If Elvis Presley is the superhero, then the arch-villain, the nemesis, the Lex Luthor to his Superman is Colonel Tom Parker. And there is, just in the colors and tones and moods of the movie, there's this sinister, lurid, it almost looks sometimes just with all of the deep saturated reds and the dark shadows, it almost looks like an Italian giallo, like an Italian horror movie from the 1970s. It's so kind of bloody and over the top in its luridness and its feeling of rot and corruption and creepy evil, which all comes from Tom Parker, who is just hideously ugly, the way that Tom Hanks is made up. He's almost like Jabba the Hutt.
I have a theory about the Tom Hanks thing. Okay, so I was reading a bunch of reviews, and there's a review, maybe it was on Slash Film, that just underscored the point that, you know, in casting Tom Hanks, you're obviously casting against type. Tom Parker is a monster. Tom Hanks is America's dad. It's meant to be like, ooh. But I actually had a thought about kind of going one step beyond that, which is, yes, there was a tremendous amount of prosthetic makeup and skin and remaking of the visage of Tom Hanks, but yet somehow not enough. Because I feel like I constantly was looking at him and being like, that's Tom Hanks.
It's a very winky performance. It's, hey, everybody, here I am, Tom Hanks. I mean, the thing is, he's such a good mimic and he's such a good sketch comic. That sometimes, I think, gets in the way of his acting. So here, this is a very hammy performance. And there's a lot of showboating. Look at me, I'm Tom Hanks, but I'm being a crazy bad guy. That, I don't know if it exactly gets in the way. It's clearly part of what Luhrmann is interested in doing in casting Tom Hanks and in construing Tom Parker as this lurid, monstrous, weird figure, but it's also very distracting because I think that Austin Butler, who plays Elvis, is a really interesting performer and is trying to do something else. Not exactly to be Elvis, not to impersonate Elvis, not to do kind of a standard biopic caricature, but to try to figure out, like, what is it like to be this person? You know, what is Elvis physically like? What is it to embody this guy who is as beautiful a human being as Tom Parker is an ugly one physically. And I did feel like Tom Hanks is kind of breaking the fourth wall by saying, hi, it's me in here. It's me in here. Got in the way of what Butler was trying to do, which was something very difficult and very artful and in a very different register.
I feel like we're on the same page. And in a way, I felt like it was Tom Hanks narrating his performance of Tom Parker, narrating the film about Elvis Presley. And again, the fourth wall stuff is interesting because that also feels very Baz Luhrmann-y to kind of be like, linear narrative, sure, whatever, not necessary. We're going to have Tom Hanks staring at you for 20 minutes dead to camera throughout this film, like letting you know that he's in on it. And I'm not of the mindset that that takes away from Butler's performance, but it is definitely, he's in a different ideological realm than Butler.
Yeah. Also, the narrative, the way the story works is that every time Elvis tries to break free, Tom Parker reins him in. And also, Elvis's full potential growth as an artist is stymied by Parker after Elvis is in the army. Like, every decision that Tom Parker makes for Elvis is wrong.
Well, it's right for Tom Parker. It's wrong for Elvis.
And it's wrong for American culture. So he says, you know, first he sends him on television. He's like, you have to wear a tuxedo and you can't gyrate. And then he sends him out in this 4th of July concert in Memphis. And, you know, the police are there. They're going to break this thing up. You have to stand perfectly still and behave yourself. And of course, Elvis doesn't. And all hell breaks loose and the law comes in and they make tons of money and Elvis Presley is Elvis Presley. And then, you know, later on, Elvis wants to explore acting, but Tom Parker just casts him in all of these crummy movies in the 1960s. And then Elvis wants to tour. Elvis wants to do all of these more musically adventurous things that Tom Parker is always trying to get him not to do. The narrative arc of the movie is that struggle, that artistic struggle between them.
Baz Luhrmann playing Elvis against Tom Parker in this kind of like pure unadulterated, like Elvis is the pure artistic vision and Tom Parker is the cynic who is also craven. I don't know to what degree that's accurate to their real relationship, right? I did find it a little awkward that it constantly paints Elvis as some kind of sainted figure. And some of the parts of the film that struck me as overwrought are the segments where he's mourning the death of Martin Luther King, the death of Bobby Kennedy. It did feel like the imposition of 2022 ideology onto a fantastical take on the 1960s. And I don't know what Elvis's relationship to those actual real life events was, but it's worth saying that the space that they are given in this film feels both gratuitous and also an extension of and rejoinder to the opening scenes where Elvis has his mind blown by blues musicians, by gospel musicians, by B.B. King, by Little Richard. It's meant to kind of close that circle and also ground him philosophically in some kind of in a liberal ideology. But we don't actually know. It didn't feel totally real to me.
We do know that he went to visit Richard Nixon in the White House.
Conveniently omitted.
Which is weirdly omitted. And that apparently, another great missed opportunity, I think, Tom Parker wanted to charge the White House $25,000 in taxpayer money for Elvis's appearance.
I mean, relatively speaking, a bargain. Yeah, let's keep it a buck.
But also a bit of chutzpah. But what you pinpoint there, the sort of the political Elvis, the liberal Elvis, the bleeding heart Elvis that we get in this, is trying to connect something that was true about Elvis's cultural and aesthetic and musical interests to a political idea that it doesn't quite sustain. So it's like, well, it's certainly true that Black music and Black musicians and Black people in Mississippi and Tennessee, where he grew up, were very important to him. But it's also true that he had a lot of messed up racial attitudes, as white people from the South in that generation did. And so to try to make him a kind of a hero, to put him at the vanguard of civil rights and social progress, rang false. I mean, he did record in the ghetto. He did love gospel music. He did love rhythm and blues. But one of the things that I think shows that kind of slight falsification at work is the way that the movie depicts another very important musical force in Elvis's life, which is country and Western, which is basically pushed to the margins and is just the square music, basically. The type of music that Tom Parker is dealing with before Elvis comes along, and then it all goes out the window and it's rock and roll. And the tension and the cross-pollination that made rock and roll is finessed in a way that has to do with pleasing modern sensibilities rather than getting into what I think is the very interesting mess that American popular music was and is. And the thing is, you can hear it on the soundtrack. The soundtrack is great. The remixes of the Elvis songs are terrific. The use of hip hop and techno and modern forms of pop, the anachronism that's such a Baz Luhrmann specialty, works beautifully at the sonic and musical level. But somehow at the story level, it doesn't quite.
Again, the stew of American popular music from, say, the 1910s to the 1950s is extremely messy, very combustible, moving back and forth from black to white to black. There's a lot happening. The narrative in this film is a lot more taut and also kind of in a way that's meant to be depicted as reverent. I think the actual story is a lot messier, but I think Baz Luhrmann thinks that he has stitched it up really nicely by basically having B.B. King give Elvis a pass to be like, yeah, sure, you could take all this. Do whatever you want. Nice car. As far as the soundtrack, I don't know if I totally agree with you. I do find it fascinating as text. I don't know that I found it effective. I do think hearing Nardo Wick rapping on an Elvis Presley song was an unexpected turn. I'm not sure really if it did what it was supposed to do. But it did play into the larger Luhrmann idea, which is this film does not strictly exist in the 50s and 60s and 70s. This film exists literally in 2022, except it's taking place in your mind and memory. It's taking place like in the USB drive in the back of your neck.
And that is what I think is most interesting to me about it. And in a way, it's not for me to say how successful it is at this, because I think what it's trying to do is not embalm, as you're saying, is not embalm Elvis or his music in the past. Not saying, you know, this is somebody who your grandparents thought was cool that we're going to teach you about. To make Elvis not an oldie, but to say, no, this is the same. The popular culture that we're in now, the music that we're listening to now, this is part of it and this belongs to it. And there's a kind of present tense. And I think it's the same thing that Lerman did with The Great Gatsby, which is, yes, this is the 20s, but this is also 21st century hypercapitalism. It's what he did with Moulin Rouge. It's, yes, this is Paris in the 1890s, but this is also wherever we are in the early 21st century movie world. And I think that it's a huge gamble because I don't know, I only know anecdotally what the kids are into these days because I'm not one of them, but I live around some. And Elvis Presley is not it. So to bring him back into the world of the pop culture and pop music now is a really fascinating thing to attempt.
Elvis is someone whose influence has been so absorbed, internalized, and become de rigueur at this point that nobody points to Elvis. Maybe the only person I've ever really interviewed who said, ah, yes, Elvis is Sturgill Simpson. But I don't know that I've come across loads of people who directly are saying, ah, Elvis is a touchstone for me. It's a touch point. But it is everywhere.
It is everywhere. But like among his contemporaries, people are probably more likely to cite Johnny Cash, who recorded at the same time for Sun Records, but who seems like the more kind of live influence now, or Little Richard, or Chuck Berry. So yeah, Elvis has been absorbed into all kinds of places where we don't even see him anymore. But what was fascinating to me about this movie, and what I think that it handled very well on the question of race, as we've been saying, if there's some wishful thinking, there's some liberal sentimentality, let's say. But on the question of sex and gender, it is on the money. And the first big concert, when Elvis takes the stage in Texarkana in 1954, the sense of danger and release and hysteria, and also of all of the rules and norms, he comes out in this pink satin suit with eye makeup on and a big pompadour, and he is scrambling every code that exists. And you feel that for me is the great scene in the movie, because you just feel all of the power of that moment right now.
This is a great Baz Luhrmann scene, because what does Baz Luhrmann do? Baz Luhrmann naturally is inclined towards that sort of scrambling. And it could be of race, sex, gender, politics, region, you know, he's not beholden to a fixed idea. So his ideal subject is a scene, an individual, a moment who is pushing back against the expectations of the circumstance. Like, that's what this movie embodies in whole, but that's what this scene embodies in specific.
And specifically the dimension of terror, of loss of control, you know, because the women are mobbing, the girls in there are going crazy and screaming their heads off. And Elvis's mother is there and she's, don't let them hurt my boy. What are they going to do to my boy? And it really is, there's a kind of deliberate classical reference there to Orpheus, the singer, being torn apart by the followers of Bacchus, by the Maenad, which is the example in kind of Western mythology of the power of art to disrupt and destroy and consume the artist and to unleash passions and desires and lust that is uncontrollable. And he gets the terror of that, which I had never thought, you know, because you always hear about it. Oh, and you see old footage of fans screaming when Elvis walks by. But that sort of puts you there in a way that I had never experienced before.
You mentioned Elvis's mom, and I will say another part of the film that I found a little bit jolting, or another recurring theme in the film, was the intimacy between Elvis and his mother, which I thought in a couple of places early in the film was depicted as quasi-sexual. And I was wondering, did that scan for you as well? And I can't speak to the accuracy of it, but it did feel like the smothering love of his mother being replaced, as you say, the intoxication of art and then the smothering love of the fans. I kept expecting Tom Hanks as Tom Parker to say, it's you, you love him, he loves you. And he kind of half says it.
in a way, it moved on from the family pretty quickly. But I did think it established some of the touchstones of the Elvis myth, right? Which was that he was one of a set of twins, the other of which died in infancy or in childbirth and was haunted by that and was very close to his mother. Went into the recording studio for the first time to record something for his mother as a gift, because that was something that Sam Phillips was doing kind of on the side to make a little extra money for Sun Records. So Elvis and Gladys, that love story is part of the Elvis lore. But as with a lot of things, I felt like, and you can't really blame it, it's a very long movie that's trying to cover a lot of ground and also include a lot of music and performance. So a lot of the psychology is shorthanded in a way. And certainly Elvis's later adult sexuality is just not dealt with pretty much at all, or very, very circumspectly, so that the age difference between him and Priscilla is something that when they're courting, you don't even realize it. It's only much later when he says, you know, something about, well, when I turned 50 and you turned 40, and you're like, oh, wait, so he's 10 years older. And he was like 24 when they met. Huh, that's, oh, you know, but you walk right by it, blink and you'll miss it.
And actually, I felt like there was a little bit of like a slight of styling going on during the scene where she leaves him for good, when she's packing her stuff and leaves Graceland for good, which apparently is pronounced Graceland, which I did not know. Everybody in the film pronounces it Graceland. But she's leaving Graceland for good. In that scene, I thought, and this is a pointed choice, she looks older than he does. They have matured her in a way where she has quite literally outgrown him. And he is not corpsed up yet in the full sense of like late Elvis, but he has been kind of like preserved in, and he's like still very sweaty, but he's kind of like preserved in amber a little bit. And she has leapfrogged him in maturity. And I felt like that was represented in the visuals as well.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And again, it's like you're comparing against the memory of the lore that has been passed down or lived through, because neither of us really lived through prime Elvis period. But I was surprised at how late in the film they got to tragic Elvis era. Because when you think of something that's cinematic, you think of this great tragic narrative, I would think you'd want a significant time devoted to the downfall. But it did feel like they got to it late, they compressed it, and then he's gone.
Yeah, it's strange that way, because the way the structure works is you have the rise, and then you have the comeback.
Bigger than the rise, in a weird way. Like, in the film, bigger than the rise.
Bigger than the rise, and the taping of the Christmas special, and the Vegas Elvis, and I think that may be that Vegas Elvis, as you were saying before, Vegas Elvis is in the Baz Luhrmann sweet spot in a big way, because it's still, he's still doing rock and roll, but he's also doing gospel choirs. He's also in Las Vegas. He's also doing these crazy television effects. And that spectacle, more than even the Texarkana Town Hall or whatever that venue was back in the South, is a much more Luhrmann-esque place. But then it has run out of room when you're getting to the downfall. But it just may be also that there's a choice that, you know, people our age or younger know late Elvis, fat Elvis, tragic Elvis, ridiculous Elvis the best. And if we have an image of Elvis, it's in the white suit with the scarf, with his paunch kind of hanging out, and the big sideburns. Like, that's the only Elvis that I knew in my life. And I think that a lot of this movie is trying to undo that and to counteract that and to say, well, yes, but, you know, for most of the time, there was this other person who is actually a lot more interesting.
In the end, even though this film ends on a down note, obviously, you know, he dies at 42. I don't know. Maybe I'm an unwell person. I don't know. But I couldn't help but feel a little exhilarated, even at the end of the movie, because I felt like the Luhrmann approach to literally Elvis's life and even his death, the radicalism, the juxtaposition, the messiness of it, even if he did clean up parts of the story, is it naive to say that sometimes popular culture, popular politics culture is, it's messy, it's sloppy, but it still merits this kind of ambitious, glorified, overwrought, hyper-real expertly visaged treatment. That's how it felt to me. I didn't feel like, damn, this really missed the point on parts of Elvis's legacy, although I feel like it did on a pure literal level. But I thought, this is one Elvis movie of, I'm sure, several, and of course, countless books, articles, album tributes, etc. A figure like Elvis merits a treatment like this, and Lorman is unlikely to have another subject that's an individual that's quite this rich.
I think that's right. I am more for this movie than against it. There were things that frustrated me about it and that didn't quite work for me, but compared to just about any other musical biopic, except for maybe Todd Haynes's I'm Not There, which similarly is an explosion or subversion of the expectations of the genre, I would much rather something like this, because precisely because of what you're saying, it's trying not to replicate the career or to find the real person or in a way to tell the truth, but to find an aesthetic wavelength on which this career and this person and this music makes sense. And it's Baz Luhrmann's wavelength. The thing that I appreciate about his movies is that they're always canonical works or situations on his own, from his own aesthetic point of view, whether he's doing Romeo and Juliet or The Great Gatsby. And I appreciate that in both of those cases, because I don't like reverence as a stance for the adaptation of literary works. I think that appropriation and aggression and imaginative repurposing is always much more interesting. And I think that's the case here. And in a way, the test of it, I feel like, is at the very end, they go to the footage of Elvis in his last concert singing Unchained Melody, which is a tremendously moving and also just kind of awful and tragic. And he's at the end of the line, but this voice is still everything. And often when movies do that, when like biopics show you the real person at the end, it deflates everything that went before. You're like, oh, well, that,
yes,
okay.
Yes,
you know,
yes,
that's the real thing. And we've been watching this, like, this cartoon.
This Monkey version.
Right, right. But this, it actually earns it. This, it has the opposite effect, where it's like, you're like, oh, yeah, this is what you've been talking about. This is what this movie has been about. And it dovetails not because Austin Butler looks exactly like Elvis Presley or because the movie has been an authentic biographical representation of him, but because it got him as an artist in some way that can stand next to who he actually was as an artist.
When I was saying earlier that this movie feels like it takes place in the present, it takes place in your mind in the present. And it is important, and this is, again, why Lorman is helpful or useful in this situation, because memory is fluid. Even if you tried to do the most faithful Elvis recreation, there'd be falsity in it, because you can't actually recreate reality. So what can you do? You can improvise upon it. You can version upon it. You can innovate and expand and bend and twist it. And at a certain point, you're going far beyond faithfulness. And that's okay. Let's leave faithfulness in the rear view. Let's make a movie about the imagination that creates the memory and historical idea of this figure. That's what the movie's about.
And then I think you're absolutely right, situates it in the present, because anytime you're listening, I mean, music does that. When you listen to music, you're listening to whenever it was recorded or wherever it came from. It is something that you are experiencing now, and movies are the same way. So I think to figure out how to get that sort of immediacy from something that belongs to the past is an enormous challenge. And I think the challenge sometimes overwhelms this movie, but I'm very interested in the way that it tackles it. And I think it's a very worthy challenge to take up, and, you know, a pretty brassy one, a pretty bold ambition.
Absolutely. Tony, love you and miss you.
Oh, such a pleasure. So good to talk to you.
We're going to come back with Alana Nash. Let's hear a little bit of something off this motion picture soundtrack. It's Edge of Reality, Tame Impala remix. Elvis Presley and Tame Impala.
I walked along a thin line, darling. Dark shadows follow me. Here's where life's dream lies disillusioned. The edge of reality.
Hey, it's Lauren Dragon from Wirecutter, the product recommendation service from the New York Times, and I test headphones. Sweat is actually conductive because of the saline content in it, so we basically make our own fake sweat and spray it over and over on these headphones to see what happens to them over time.
This is 85 dB of airplane noise. We're going to put on some noise-canceling headphones and see how well they actually block out the sound.
Put them on the ground and kick them over there.
Okay.
Go. Are they broken?
No.
I have 3,136 entries in my database.
Kids, workout, running.
Does it have a connector that's Lightning or USB-C? What version of Bluetooth is it? Does it have FDX HD? We have ones that track your... At Wirecutter, we do the work so you don't have to. For independent product reviews and recommendations for the real world, come visit us at nytimes.com/Wirecutter. We even have one that's solar powered.
We are back. As promised, we're going to get a little deep on Elvis history, Tom Parker history. Alana Nash is here. Alana, welcome to Popcast. Happy to have you.
Oh, this is fun. Thank you.
It is going to be fun. Okay, so Alana's been writing for a very long time, has written several books, four of which are about Elvis and surrounding folks, including The Colonel, The Extraordinary Story of Colonel Tom Parker and Elvis Presley, and Baby Let's Play House, Elvis Presley and the Women Who Loved Him. I wanted to have Alana come on because in the first segment, we were talking about Baz Luhrmann's lack of preoccupation with reality and truth and commitment to fact. All well and good. That said, I did leave the film with some questions, and I wanted to get a sense holistically of how faithful it was. Alana, you already tackled a bunch of this in your Vanity Fair piece about what the film got wrong. You want to give us just a quick sketch? If you had to give a film like a 1 to 10 rating, super faithful to not very faithful to fact, where would you put it in that arc?
I guess a 5, really, because some things just total fabrication. And some things are, well, if you're a serious student of Elvis Presley's life and career, you'll have some trouble with the film. Because many scenes are either out of order on the timeline, or they're presented in different locations or combined with other situations and circumstances, such as several early concerts where near riots broke out. And then there's this famous Russwood Park concert in Memphis where the film has a huge riot break out, and that just didn't happen. But then artistic license really sets in elsewhere, such as Elvis firing Colonel Parker from the stage in Las Vegas and calling him an alien. He never fired him from the stage. He did try to fire him on another occasion, and he didn't know that the colonel was not a U.S. citizen. But that scene is very loosely based on an incident in the early 1970s on stage where Elvis criticized the owner of the Hilton Hotel over the firing of an employee. And after that, he had a confrontation with Parker and fired him, only to resume things as they were. So you can see how those things play out in the film, but not as they really came down.
You mentioned when we talked the other day that you'd seen the film 4 times.
Yes.
Do you feel, having seen it multiple times, are the sacrifices of fact worthwhile sacrifices in favor of the narrative of the film and the aesthetic of the film as it is made? Or do you find it, because you're so knowledgeable and so steeped in the history, too much to trade off?
I do think that the film is just a big, exhilarating mess. It's 2 hours and 39 minutes, but wow, they really zip by. A lot of the fans get really caught up in the details. Like, they complain that Elvis's plane, the Lisa Marie, comes up several times in the film, but Elvis didn't get the plane until 1975. And other than the ending, the movie doesn't go past about 1973. And we see the same kind of thing with Elvis's jumpsuits that he wouldn't have worn in the time frame of the film. And it's interesting that these dramatic and chronological distortions bother the European fans most. Of course, if you really want to know anything, if you want to know anything about American popular culture, ask a European, because overseas, they spell America E-L-V-I-S. I would say the best thing to do is just go see the film as entertainment and try not to make historical sense of it or worry that there's no Elvis meeting Nixon or other key events in his life, let alone key people, and just enjoy it. The music is a trip.
Elvis feels like one of the few figures in the history of popular music whose career can sustain a film of this nature, a film that's so obviously hyper-stylized, so obviously rooted in the fantastical. Elvis is myth and exists somewhere beyond influence, I think. He's so woven into the fabric you barely see him anymore. And because he's achieved this kind of mythos status, to do something that maybe was hewing a little bit more closely to like the quote unquote facts, specifics, maybe you sacrifice the opportunity to play with mythology. And I think this film is like much more interested in mythology than history, if that makes sense.
Oh, it totally makes sense. Yes. But, you know, it's very difficult to find the real man anymore in anything that is out in the world, and more every day now, and especially with this film. The real guy gets tamped down so much you can barely find him.
There were a few moments that, when I was watching them, felt unusual to me, and a lot of them had to do with Elvis's engagement with Black musicians, Black culture, Black spaces, and also spilling over into the assassination of Martin Luther King and his reaction to that, the assassination of Bobby Kennedy and his reaction to that. To what degree do we know how Elvis did in real life respond to those events?
We do know that he was very distressed about the assassinations of King and Kennedy. He was very much affected by that, according to Baz Luhrmann. I interviewed Baz a few weeks ago, and he said that Jerry Schilling had said that when King was shot, he said, Dr. King, he always spoke the truth. And that is a line in the film, and allegedly that comes straight from Jerry Schilling. So we know that's true. The film makes a great deal, a great case for kind of rescuing Elvis from this notion that he appropriated Black music. And in doing that, Baz Luhrmann takes a lot of artistic license in putting him, say, with B.B. King's best buddy, almost. They knew each other. They didn't go hang together, as the film says.
Yeah, B.B. King didn't pull him into a club on Beale Street. That didn't happen.
That didn't happen. They did know each other. They weren't best buddies. They ran into each other at Sun Studio. Elvis did a charity show that he was on, and they visited backstage and had a picture made. And when Elvis was in Las Vegas and he was playing the Big Room and BB was playing the Lounge, he would invite him up. But it wasn't that they would hang together and discuss the arc of Elvis's career. I would say that in stressing the Black influence, the film omits musically his country influences and other white musical influences. The film would have you believe they were all Black.
The stew of popular music, blues into country, eventually into rock and roll, there's a lot of give and take moving across racial lines. And that's maybe more complicated of a narrative than Baz Luhrmann has space for, or really... Again, this is fantasy. So that's a complication that doesn't fit into a fantastical narrative. To what degree do we know, even if he wasn't close with B.B. King specifically, the Black musicians of the time who were beginning to gain popularity, what do we know about how they felt about Elvis in real time as it was happening?
I've asked this of some Black musicians and also Black fans in Memphis. And let me talk about the fans first. I asked this of a man who would have been an older teenager when Elvis first hit the scene in Memphis. And I said, what did the Black kids think of Elvis? And he said, are you kidding me? Of course we liked it. What are you talking about? Like, why wouldn't we have? I think a lot of the Black musicians thought it was great that he was getting that sound out there. You know, he became the great unifier, melding Black and white sounds into what you just said, an irresistible stew of sound. And then he added red dirt country and Southern gospel and stirred it all with a big American stick before he sent it out into the world, you know, with this kind of curled lip bravado that he had in the early days. You remember that curled lip? We didn't see too much of that after a while. But no, he continued to go see Black artists all of his life when he could go anywhere, really. He would take in when he was in Hollywood making films and somebody like Jackie Wilson was playing. He would go see him, you know, with the entourage.
Another thing that really stood out to me as a head scratch moment, when we were arriving late in the film at the Christmas special, is it true that Tom Parker doesn't know what songs are going to be performed until he shows up that day? Was the schism between the two of them really that vast at that time?
No, Tom Parker knew that it wasn't going to be quite the Christmas special that he envisioned, but he finally acquiesced and he said, there is one Christmas song in that special, which is Blue Christmas. And Parker knew that. That is one of the scenes that I find most annoying about Parker, that it really shows him to be bumbling and inept and almost comedic in the way they make fun of him. So that's not precisely how it came down. He did need to stay true to his contract to NBC to have a Christmas special. He filmed in June, but to run in December. But I think he eased up as he saw what it was turning into. I think he wasn't thrilled with the idea that he didn't have the control over it that he had wanted. And he really did worry about the influence that Steve Bender had over Elvis for the future, as Elvis wanted to keep him involved in his career. The Colonel didn't like that at all and cut off all access to him in the future.
As far as the actual dynamic between the two of them, between Elvis and Parker in real life, you mentioned the Vanity Fair piece that you feel maybe the film is like slightly, maybe lightly ungenerous to Parker.
Well, it doesn't show you what he did right, which is pretty important. Parker's handling of Presley defined the role of manager as an architect of popular culture. And you could call him, honestly, the father of American popular culture, because he drew a straight line from the ballyhoo stage of the carnival, that's how he started in American carnivals, to the makeshift performance platforms of rock and roll, all through his merchandising and promotion of his client. He's also important in the ways that he figured out how to keep his star on top in his succession of records and movies and special events, such as the comeback special and the satellite special, and finally Vegas. And then when Elvis died, his actions on behalf of Vernon and Lisa Marie Presley became quite the example in protecting the rights of dead celebrities and their estates.
Is there something about how the movie is structured that can't sustain Parker as anything other than a villain? Does the movie not work if Parker is a more sympathetic character? Because obviously, one of the things that's fascinating about the character is it's being played by Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks is, you know, a very genial, affable person. I feel like he's constantly like winking at you, like, yes, I know, it's me, Tom Hanks. I'm playing this absolute menace of a person. I know it, but it's me. Don't worry, it's me. Do you think if Parker is like a more nuanced character, it kind of doesn't work in the context of the movie?
I actually think it would have made his character much more interesting. We have the senators talking about the fact that there are no records before his army records, and the army records, he got an honorable discharge, as it turns out, because his discharge paper says acute institutional psychopathic state. That is something that I got it and just about fell off my chair when that document came through the fax machine back in 1997. Constitutional psychopathic state.
That's traceable back to your research.
It is. But in the film, you have the senators finally saying, what made you flee Holland? Why did you flee Holland? And that is never addressed again. But obviously, Parker had secrets that he worked very hard to protect. And I think if we had seen a little more of that conflict within, he would have been a much more sympathetic and interesting character. I also found in my research something I thought was really interesting. In Holland, there's a great deal of importance put on the celebration of birthdays. And I found out that one year, and Parker always made a big thing of his birthday, I found out that one year Elvis forgot it. And that night, his wife and a man who was staying in the house heard crying, heard sobbing. And the fellow, who was a guy named Byron Raphael, who worked for William Morris, but was assigned to the colonel, asked the colonel's wife the next morning, what was the crying? And she said, well, Elvis forgot his birthday. Just some little thing like that, some little vignette or anecdote like that might have made the caricature come full circle to something a little more human and not quite so villainous.
I feel like I've seen some divergent opinions about Austin Butler's effectiveness as Elvis. I feel like is a very embodied portrayal, even if some of the specifics don't seem quite right. But as a character, it felt pretty strong to me as a standalone character. But one thing that I think was the most effective part of a broadly effective portrayal is there is a physicality to how he's playing that role. And I think the physicality of Elvis was really crucial. And to see it in this kind of fantastical way, to my eye, felt effective, alive, and invested. I wonder, given your history writing so intimately about Elvis and everybody around Elvis, was it hard to accept Austin Butler as Elvis, or were you able to give in?
Oh, I think it's pretty easy to accept him as Elvis. First of all, he had those dance moves down. He had those performance moves down. He managed, you know, I really didn't think anybody would be able to do that or embody him. I always thought if you really made a film about Elvis and the Colonel, you'd have to use existing footage of the real Elvis because nobody could really play Elvis convincingly. But wow, I mean, there are scenes when his accent is not, you know, is a little off. But when he's on stage, Austin Butler kills it.
Part of the fantasy, like Elvis is the fantasy, right? It's like you have to commit. If you don't believe, if Butler doesn't do it right, the whole film kind of falls apart. And I mean that in a visual way, not so much in a line for line way. If he doesn't nail the physicality, the whole thing falls apart. Now, I do agree, he does kill it. But what about Elvis the human? Because I will say that the few moments where I feel like the film asks us to reckon with Elvis the human, that doesn't come across quite as strongly. And if anything, it takes me out of the fantasy to have to reckon with the specificity of his character.
Well, I found him not very believable when he's crying over his mother's dresses in the closet. That was about the only time I had thought, we're trying too hard here, not really embodying even sorrow. I mean, you see him when he's on the shows talk about he lost his mother at the same age as Elvis, and it allowed him to step into that moment. But then actually, when you see that in the film, it doesn't come across.
No, it's almost maybe unkind to say, but when he's talking, it's not working. When he's dancing, it's working. When he's walking, when he's strutting, when he's wearing a sport coat, it works. But the minute the talking starts, it all starts to collapse a little bit. And I think it's probably wise that there are long stretches of this film where I feel like he's not doing too much talking.
I think he's quite good when he does confront the Colonel from the stage and when he confronts him as he's going out to the parking lot in the hotel. Even though those events didn't really happen that way, I think that Austin as an actor is strongest in those moments. Back to the real Elvis, his appeal is rooted in his originality, in the depth of his artistry, in his sexual daring, in his exotic looks and sound. I mean, he was almost equal parts male and female, white and black. And in the early days, country and blues. He's all things meaningful and fanciful that just swirl in our imaginations all the time. And I have to say, when Austin Butler is performing, he is Elvis.
Do you feel like after this film, is it just useless? Like no one else should try to make an Elvis, fictionalized Elvis film after this? You know what I mean? Because what can you really do? The only option I feel is to do something that's like very sober. As much as this is a theatrical, hyper-real film, to do something that's literal and almost like microscopically accurate. That's maybe the only pathway left.
And probably something done by another European and something on a very small scale. Instead of doing something huge, take it down. And I do think that they haven't gotten the Colonel yet. You know, he just wasn't really that guy that we saw. So I'd love to see another exploration of Colonel and Elvis together that was maybe black and white, for example.
Interesting. And also that notion that it should be a smaller film. I agree, because you can't compete with this on scale. It's just not possible. You have to strike out completely different territory, different pathway altogether. Are there any specific moments after having seen it now a few times that really do stick with you in a positive way? And you look at it as a historian and say, that's the true spirit, both of Elvis, of Tom Parker. What sticks in your mind now, days later?
Well, I think for Elvis, the arc of his story rings true. And the spirit of that young fellow who, as we see in the film, in the Ferris wheel scene, he's ready to fly. But then, of course, we see what happens at the end with that very poignant language from Tennessee Williams, The Fugitive Kind, about the bird with no legs. That I do think that his struggle, his inability to break away from the stronghold of the Colonel and of his father also, really, who's in cahoots with the Colonel, and also of his inability to handle fame rings true. What you don't see is, you know, Elvis the man never really matured much beyond the age of 18. The only time he really tried to grow, I think, was in his readings of spiritual texts and to figure out what there was beyond this world. Other than that, his world is very small and juvenile, really. But we don't see that in the film. But the Colonel, I think that I was very disappointed in Tom Hanks's portrayal, beginning with the accent, where he's really good is when he's in negotiations with, we're supposed to believe it's the mob there in Las Vegas about Elvis's ongoing career there at the International Hotel. There, Hanks, really, you really see him, the gift that he has, I think.
I do think the accent, for what it's worth, maybe it's almost intentionally a little bit bad. Because again, I do think there's this meta-narrative pulsing through the Hanks portrayal. You're never supposed to be comfortable that's a fully embodied character. You're supposed to be mindful that he's playing the part. Whereas with Elvis, I do think you're supposed to get lost in Butler's portrayal. You're supposed to sign on and say, ah, that's Elvis. But with Hanks, he's both the second protagonist in the film. He is the narrator of the film. The character of Tom Parker is the narrator of the film. And then Tom Hanks is like somewhere underneath there being like, yeah, it's me, it's Tom. So I do think the accent is meant to be a little bit like, that's odd. It's meant to make you never make you comfortable.
Yes. In fact, I asked Baz Luhrmann about the accent. He said, well, he wanted to emphasize the strangeness of this character. Like, who is he really? But then that falls apart for two reasons. It's not consistent sometimes in the film.
Definitely
he barely
not.
Uses it, and other times it's very prominent. And then the other thing is that Elvis is supposed to be so surprised to find that Colonel is not an American. I mean, he would really have had to have had a tin ear not to pick up on that accent, really.
Again, it all works in the fantasy land, I suppose.
That's right. It does.
As we go out, is there a particular, whether it's a performance from the film or an old Elvis song that's special to you that we can play over the closing credits?
Oh, gosh. You know, the one that Colonel liked was Are You Lonesome Tonight? But my favorite is Baby Let's Playhouse. I like that hiccuping rockabilly. To me, that is the essential early Elvis that shows how exciting and electrifying he was.
And also a great moment in the film.
Yes.
Okay, we'll go out with that. That is our show. Thank you to Tony Scott. Thank you to Alana Nash. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com. If you have any questions, thoughts, concerns about Elvis and the career of Elvis and Baz Luhrmann's meaty handling of the Elvis legacy, get in the Discord. New URL, tinyurl.com/podcast Discord. Get in the Facebook group, tinyurl.com/podcast Facebook. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content. That's Apple, that's Spotify, Google, Stitcher, et cetera, et cetera. Our producer, we're back on solid ground in the normal rooms this week. It's Pedro Rosado from Head Stepper Media. We will be back next week. Baby, let's play house.
Come on back to me, little girl, so we can play some house now, baby. Come back, baby, come. Come back, baby, come. Come back, baby, home.